Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And what you don't know was supposed to protect you, right? But it may not be. Two examples this hour, the NFL's knowledge about the risk of serious head injury not shared with players hardly protected them. We'll talk about a landmark settlement of a huge lawsuit. We don't know what's about to happen in Syria now as the Obama White House contemplates a military strike. We do know the world's capacity to be surprised and impressed by U.S. action has seriously diminished in the past few decades. Bill Keller of the New York Times on that. But perhaps most threatening of all, the secrecy surrounding how much this country spends and why and how on national security intelligence programs, from the Defense Intelligence Agency to the NSA to the CIA. The Washington Post, relying on leaks from Edward Snowden, but also carefully vetting and consulting with government officials on what kinds of information might compromise national security, has opened an unprecedented window onto the so-called secret black budget, a 178-page summary outlining $52.6 billion of budget spending by the U.S. National Intelligence Agency for fiscal year 2013. We've never known a number like that ever before. In a statement to the Washington Post, Director of National Intelligence James R. Clapper said, "The U.S. has made a considerable investment in the intelligence community since the terror attacks of 9/11, a time which includes wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Arab Spring, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction technology, and asymmetric threats in such areas as cyber warfare." Well, how thrilled or how terrified are we by all this? We're joined by Lee Hamilton, director of the Center on Congress at Indiana University. Congressman Hamilton served 34 years in the House of Representatives, is currently a member of the President's Homeland Security Advisory Council and the CIA External Advisory Board. Congressman Hamilton, welcome back.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
My first question to you is, should the American people know about how much money is being spent and why on these kinds of programs?
Yes, I think they should. Intelligence has now become a very major part of the taxpayers' burden. Obviously, you have to be careful about revealing sources and methods and legitimate government secrets. But we ought not to have a government agency that has the power the intelligence agency has, that has the size the intelligence agencies have, the ability to intrude, if you will, into the lives of Americans to the extent that they do, without some public discussion and public dialogue, and that can be done. What was revealed yesterday gives us a base for beginning a public dialogue on the intelligence community.
You know, the question that comes to mind to me, and I know you've lived this for much of your career, is that when there's secrecy, when there's no public accountability, the temptation exists to, you know, spend more. The temptation exists to utilize secret budgets that are out of the public domain to project policies that would be voted down if they were discussed in an open forum. There's plenty of evidence that that's what's gone on here, that administrations have used the black budget to fund programs they didn't want to publicly disclose, and that the spending within the security establishment really has just exceeded all measures of inflation.
Well, there isn't any doubt about that. They now intercept all of your telephone calls, all of your emails for all practical purposes. They know a great deal about you, or at least they can find out a great deal about you. And even if you grant the good intentions and the goodwill of the present people conducting these programs, once you grant government power, government doesn't give that power up. So what you have to be alert to here is not just abuse of power at the present time, but abuse of power in perpetuity.
I'm wondering, though, if the intelligence committees and the sort of secrecy within Congress and the briefings that the White House is, by statute, supposed to give Congress is sufficient accountability looking at this document, the level of spending, the level of increases in spending and the like.
I do not think either the courts or the Congress have been sufficiently robust in demanding transparency of the intelligence community over a period of decades, really. This information given to us yesterday on the budget is enormously significant in all kinds of ways. It tells us a lot about the priorities of the intelligence community. We're entitled to know that. It tells us about the limitations of intelligence. We should know that. It tells us about how much money they're spending on cyber defense and cyber offense. They're telling us how big a problem they have with insiders, 4,000 of them being investigated within the intelligence community in a single year.
Isn't that the scariest thing that you saw, that was their plan?
It's the most surprising thing that they have such an enormous problem, and I guess Snowden is an example of it. They have such an enormous problem trusting their own people.
Finally, in this system here, as we look at this budget, is the Constitution itself at risk here when so much of this is black underneath the veil of secrecy? Even the Constitution will be violated without the kinds of accountability and checks and balances that would prevent that.
Well, I think that's exactly the point. Our system does not permit enormous power to gather at any single source, even though that source may be the presidency, the executive branch of the government. It demands that checks and balances from the other branches of government, from the media, from the American public be put in place. And that's what's at stake here. Keep in mind, the figure that was released yesterday is only a part of the intelligence budget. What is missing is the defense intelligence budget, which approaches $25 billion. So you see a major portion here, but it's much, much larger than what the article reveals. And all of that represents very big government, very intrusive government, very powerful government, and it needs checks and it needs balances to the maximum extent possible under the security of the country.
Lee Hamilton is director of the Center on Congress at Indiana University, served 34 years in the House of Representatives as a member of the president's Homeland Security Advisory Council as well, and the CIA External Advisory Board. Congressman Hamilton, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here are two snapshots of American power projected across the world. An image of nearly limitless accomplishment.
I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda.
Power, success, technology, remote control, victory. Now an image of fiasco exactly 20 years ago.
My message to you is your country is grateful, and so is the rest of the world, and so are the vast majority of the Somali people. Our mission from this day forward is to increase our strength, do our job, bring our soldiers out, and bring them home.
President Clinton announcing the withdrawal from Somalia after the deadly ambush of American Army Rangers and Marines that became known as Black Hawk Down. When the U.S. projects its military power today, there is a complicated series of competing images that accompanies the warnings, accusations, and speeches.
Spitfires rose from British bases and fought for the domination of the air over the desolate beach, while ground forces continued a stubborn rearguard action.
At the end of World War II, America's unchallenged superiority was an abstract but undeniable threat to everyone. It was not abstract to the Japanese, who had seen what nuclear weapons could do. Vietnam and Korea, though, raised serious questions about what could be accomplished on the battlefield in the Cold War and the tens of thousands of American soldiers who could be lost there. Attacks against Marines in Lebanon in the 1980s showed the limits of U.S. peacekeeping between two antagonists like the Israelis and the Palestinians. But some lessons seem to have been learned by 1991.
5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined. This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries.
An overwhelming force an overwhelming consensus led by George H.W. Bush, Iraq was removed from Kuwait, Vietnam was removed from national memory.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane. We just saw another plane coming in from the side.
But the 9/11 attacks created something not seen since World War II, a collective Pearl Harbor-like spirit of national mourning and outrage, channeled into the invasion first of Afghanistan and then the case for going after Iraq once and for all, a case regrettably made by Secretary of State Colin Powell.
One of the most worrisome things that emerges from the thick intelligence file we have on Iraq's biological weapons is the existence of mobile production facilities used to make biological agents. Let me take you inside that intelligence file and share with you what we know from eyewitness accounts.
I brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours.
It was shock and awe in Iraq, certainty and arrogance, soldiers alongside media embeds, missions accomplished, and then the whole business unraveled.
Back in the days of shock and awe, we came to liberate them all.
Today, the images of Iraq quagmire and Abbottabad quick raid strike are two sides of the same U.S. military coin. And today, with the options being debated over Syria, there is no shock, no awe.
If, in fact, we make a choice to have repercussions for the use of chemical weapons.
As a father, I can't get the image out of my head.
Then the Assad regime, which is involved in a civil war, trying to protect itself.
Of a man who held up his dead child, wailing while chaos swirled around him.
Will have received a pretty strong signal that, in fact, it better not do it again.
Human suffering that we can never ignore or forget.
There is considerable fatigue about the unpredictability of all this. Memories of Black Hawks Down, losses of ambassadors in Benghazi, and questions after 2003 that hardly need to be asked about U.S. credibility over any case it makes regarding the use of weapons of mass destruction. In a few minutes, Bill Keller, former executive editor of the New York Times, joins us to discuss the contemplated military intervention in Syria and where it fits into our complicated history. And we've been hearing your thoughts. Should the United States use military power in Syria?
My name is Kim. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. And it is time for somebody to stand up and take a stance against using this type of weapon against their own people. We stood by and watched this happen time and time and time again. Somebody has to stand up.
Lonnie Higgins from Hawaii. My take is no military involvement led by any other nation other than the Arab League. The presence of chemical weapons is an issue for that region to contain and take leadership in.
Love to know what you think. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Bill Keller of the New York Times is next. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
So America's reputation as a nuclear superpower, its military experiences in Vietnam, Panama, Somalia, Beirut, Iraq, and Afghanistan all inform a world trying to evaluate what may happen now that the U.S. is contemplating some retaliatory strike against Syria in the Middle East. Joining us now is Bill Keller, former executive editor of the New York Times, current op-ed columnist for the paper. Bill Keller, welcome back.
Hi, John.
So what do you think of a little bit of the history that I recounted there and some you may add? What do you think casts the longest shadow on this decision whether to retaliate in Syria? And from the Syrian perspective, what might they be most concerned with or think is the highest probability of an outcome?
Well, I was thinking as I was listening to your windup that they say that generals are always fighting the last war, and it's kind of true of countries too, fighting or not fighting. But we're sort of enthralled to the last experience, especially if it was a very profound or traumatic one. And the thing that casts a shadow over the question of Syria is Iraq. You have you know, another autocrat who represents a sectarian minority. You have another kind of dubious collection of opposition factions competing for foreign help, patronage. You have some of the same voices, John McCain, for instance, you know, exhorting us to intervene. You have the familiar fears of a quagmire. You even have the sort of murky intelligence about WMD again. And so, to, I think to a lot of people, this feels like, oh my God, here we go again. And I think it feels that way to the president and the administration. There is a real sense of, you know, we're not going to be fooled again.
Although there's a really curious irony here in the sense, and some of your commentators at the New York Times have suggested this as well, that Syria has managed to become Iraq circa 2006 without any real help from the United States or an invasion. It's managed to do this on its own.
Yeah, you mean hurtling downhill towards a failed state.
Yes.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, you know, I've written on a couple of occasions that I think this clouds our judgment of Syria in a bad way. It's important to focus on the things about Syria that are not like Iraq. First and foremost, in Iraq, the whole argument of an American national interest was largely fabricated and based on bogus intelligence. In Syria, we have a real national interest. You can argue about what you should do about it, but it's not Iraq in that respect. A failed Syria would become a haven for terrorists, and now with access to chemical weapons, which they have in abundance in Syria, be a danger to surrounding countries, which are all American allies. It would be threatened to prompt a regional Sunni-Shiite sectarian war, which kind of seems to be more likely by the day. It would embolden Iran and Hezbollah, which are both supporting the Assad regime. And it sends a message to a lot of places, notably Iran, that we don't, you know, that our threats are hollow.
Well, then how tragic is it, and maybe I'm preempting your answer here, that if this is the conflict where we really do have a national interest, did we, in a sense, squander our national will, our fiscal sort of ability to pay for such a conflict, and even the military's capacity to support an on-the-ground conflict like this in Iraq? We squandered it in Iraq and do not have the capacity, really, to accomplish anything significant in Syria.
I think that's right. I don't know about the capacity. The biggest limit on our capacity, and there are a number. I mean, when you get into that region, there is no such thing as a cakewalk, to coin a phrase. But the biggest limitation on our ability to influence events in Syria is our reluctance to influence events in Syria. The reality is the president does not have the stomach for a serious engagement in the Middle East, and the American public seems to have no stomach for it. And for that matter, the British public and parliament have no stomach for it, and they were sort of first to line up and be our allies in Iraq. So, yes, I think we did. The debacle of Iraq diminished our national will in a way that could cost us. And in Syria, by the way, you know, one other important difference between Syria and Iraq is at least 6 months, a year, 18 months ago, we had pretty good options that it did not involve putting Americans on the ground. Whether those options are, I think the potential for those options wanes day by day as the situation gets more chaotic. But you know, there was nobody except possibly the enemies of America wants to see American troops in Syria.
So the lesson from Iraq is bluff the U.S. and you can call them, challenge the U.S. and they will wait and the situation will deteriorate. And they certainly have no more capacity to shock and awe anyone.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably the message we've been sending. I don't think that's the message that necessarily had to be sent. But yes, I mean, look at this latest use of chemical weapons. You know, Obama's now in a situation where he backed down once. After the first allegations of chemical weapons, he said we'd arm the rebels, we raised their expectations, and then we did pretty much nothing. So you could look at this latest, much bigger attack with chemical weapons as Assad calling Obama's bluff.
Well, it's amazing. A legacy that Obama and George Bush, George W. Bush, will share. Bill Keller, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bill Keller is the former executive editor of the New York Times. He's a current op-ed columnist for the Times. Let's take a moment now and remember someone who had praise for Samuel Beckett, William Butler Yeats, and Eminem. Irish poet Seamus Heaney has died at age 74. A poet at home in the classics and in the working fields of his boyhood, he once described his pen as a tool to dig into the potato mold and the soggy peat of his Northern Ireland home. Heaney's The Cure at Troy is an appropriate sentiment, I think, for this difficult week of thoughts about war and remembrances of history in America. History says don't hope on this side of the grave, but then once in a lifetime the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracle and cures and healing wells. This is The Takeaway.
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
It's movie time on Friday here with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Kristen, Rafer, welcome.
Hi, John. Hi, John.
So I'm looking here. We've got a British crime thriller and two documentaries. Is it August or what?
End of summer.
Indeed. Let's begin with Our Nixon.
I was very tough on people, feeling that I had to be. There's something about the presidency that I've been ridiculed for my picking up the Navy term of zero defects, but you do have to operate at as close to zero defect as you can. And I was not overly concerned with whether people liked me as a result of it or not. I was only concerned that the result the president wanted, that carried out.
Now, for Nixon buffs there, that's H.R. Bob Halderman, some bad sort of scratchy audio there. Is this Penny Lane, Our Nixon documentary history? Is it voyeurism? What do you think, Rafer?
Well, it's comprised largely of Super 8 footage that Haldeman and two other aides took when they were young bucks working in the White House. Sounds pretty juicy, you know, all this Super 8 footage that was discovered when all the Watergate tapes were being seized. It's kind of interesting, but I think you get a lot of shots of sort of wildlife outside of the White House, squirrels, birds, people eating. Some of that footage did not seem that illuminating to me.
So it didn't work as powerfully as, say, Fog of War, which was all about McNamara and Vietnam.
It's a very different movie. I mean, to me, the most interesting part was this is a time where, unlike today, nowadays, we document everything. We put it all out on Facebook. We videotape everything. This is a time where that wasn't the case. But there were over 4,000 hours of Super 8 tapes, from what I understand, that they had to go through in order to make this movie. And what I liked about it is it showed on a human level how this affected people, people who actually loved Nixon, who were friends with him, who went to family gatherings together, the individuals who actually were friends with him.
Sounds quite interesting. The British crime thriller we're talking about, Closed Circuit. Let's listen.
What is she doing here?
Ask her yourself.
She and I are not allowed to communicate.
An exception can be made for the common courtesies.
Until the actual delivery of the closed material, I am permitted to communicate with Mr. Rhodes. Whether or not I choose to do so is another matter.
Terrorism, apocalypse, all of the ingredients for a summer blockbuster. Is this a really big release, Kristen?
I think that this is very timely. It's dealing with the ideas of terrorism, our trust in government, surveillance. The problem with this being so timely is also that it feels very obvious. It doesn't actually feel surprising. And the pace at which it goes is pretty slow, actually. It really should be much more punchy and move at a faster clip.
Feels like a documentary. Rafer?
Yeah, that clip you heard is about as exciting as it gets, really, for an espionage thriller.
Ooh.
And, you know, I would have liked a lot more fist throwing and guns going off. And I would have liked, frankly, a little more romance and chemistry between Eric Bana and Rebecca Hall in that clip there.
Romance, chemistry, excitement. How about One Direction?
There's times when they've dressed us all in the same clothes and we're like, no, we
can't do that.
This is the I'm gonna rob your nan look.
It's like having five rowdy boys in a class at school.
One Direction, This Is Us, the documentary about the boy band. You can hear in the beginning the screaming of the young girls on America's Got Talent.
So much screaming in this movie. They are huge. They're so huge that their fan base was so large before they even had an album out, and they had to create an album before they went on a world tour. And we actually are talking with Morgan Spurlock on our new Movie Date podcast, and he's going to explain all of this if people want to hear that. But most of the film, what's most focused on are these fans, really, really, really hardcore young girls who love this band.
All right. Well, they're definitely going to get a treat this weekend. Kristen Meinzer, their culture producer for The Takeaway, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. They are the Movie Date podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Think back for a moment. Richard Milhouse Nixon shines so brightly in American history that the men and women around him kind of fade into a mysterious black and white. They're washed out, flat, blurry when compared to that distinctive voice and historic crimes of the only U.S. president ever to resign. The names of those around him, his wife Pat, curiously unknown, H.R. Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, Dwight Chapin, mere henchmen of Watergate, as history recalls them, henchmen in a palace worthy of the Borgias, dark, full of backstabbing and intrigue.
I took a camera on all my trips, a Super 8, and I have quite a collection of film. I've never laughed as much as when I worked in the Nixon White House. The sense of humor was the leveling factor, things, messes we would find ourselves in, or whatever it might be.
The Wacky Laughing Days of Nixon. That's a selection from the documentary Our Nixon, and that's Dwight Chapin thinking back to his days in the Nixon White House, accompanied by Super 8 movie footage of those days between 69 and 73, home movies of everything from Nixon's inauguration to Tricia Nixon's wedding, pictures taken by Chapin, Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman, Chief Domestic Advisor John Ehrlichman, 500 reels, all of which were seized by FBI during the Watergate investigation, but they form the core of this new documentary by Penny Lane called Our Nixon, which we've noted is in limited release today. Director Penny Lane is here in the studio. What a treasure trove.
Yeah, kind of.
Did it bring these characters alive for you, characters that we really feel like are black and white cartoon characters?
Yeah, almost? Literally. I mean, I think quite literally in my mind, these three men were represented by a single photograph each, all of which were from the Watergate hearings and from, in the Chapin's case, from a later court date. But I knew the history pretty well, so I knew their names. But it instantly became obvious the minute I saw these home movies that I didn't know anything about them.
From their point of view, the Nixon White House becomes a fun, carefree kind of romp through history. Does it feel that way when you look at the Super 8 footage?
Sure. I mean, you see that that's their position. You know, you can't help – you feel it. It's kind of an infectious, exciting, you know, colorful, awesome experience to work with the president of the United States and to get to go to all these amazing places and meet the world leaders and all these things. So, yeah, you feel it in the footage for sure.
Do you think Nixon selected the people around him to be so sort of anonymous to history, or is it just the way Watergate – painted everyone? Is there something about their relationship?
I think that actually – so H.R. Haldeman was largely responsible for the kind of complexion of the staff's structure in the White House. He was actually the first chief of staff. There was no chief of staff before that. This was the first time that kind of person existed. And the chief of staff is the person who kind of sets the tone and sets the pace and decides what the complexion and character of the staff will be. And he had very specific ideas about what those roles were. And ego was not supposed to be part of it. And you see in the film that there's some tension between a Haldeman and a Kissinger because, you know, Haldeman thinks that Kissinger has an ego, which he did, you know, which was actually a benefit to his role in some ways. But to someone like a Haldeman, it was all about what does the president of the United States want and how can I make that happen, period.
What did these men, at least those who you were able to be a part of and collaborate with, think about you opening this bit of history?
Oh, I didn't collaborate with any of them. So the entire film was made just through archival research and piecing together clips from the historical record. Toward the end of the film, we sent a copy to Dwight Chapin, who is the only of the three who is still alive, to sort of just let him know that we were doing this and that the press might be contacting him. So he
and his response, his sense?
His response was mixed. I mean, as you can imagine, it's a bit odd for him to have someone else take his home movies and fashion it into something that's not a film he would have made. I think he saw that we were trying to bring out the humanity and the brotherhood and the idealism of these young men. I think he really liked that. But what he didn't like was anything that smacked of making Nixon look anything other than perfect and
really
wonderful. Well, yeah, he's absolutely, you know, he would say himself, a Nixon loyalist. He's still very concerned that history got it wrong and that Nixon's legacy will one day, you know, shine.
Triumph over.
Yeah.
Oh, that's remarkable. That's almost Shakespearean. Penny Lane, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Penny Lane, director of Our Nixon, which goes into limited release today, a documentary on the Nixon years. Sports. Are you an entertainer like a dancer, dazzling huge audiences and filling seats by the millions? Or are you more an industrial worker, scraping at the limits of what the human body can do to extract gold from stone, coal from dark caves, wrestling giant machines in a fast-moving workplace, confusing where a single mistake could injure you for life? NFL football players and their families would recognize both descriptions of what they do any given Sunday, Monday, or Thursday. But the NFL has now recognized that it needs to draw a line under one of the most important worker liability cases in history. After months of court-ordered mediation, senior U.S. District Judge Anita Brody in Philadelphia has laid out details of a planned $765 million settlement with 4,000 NFL plaintiffs, millions to fund medical exams, concussion-related compensation, and medical research. A significant settlement, but one that the nearly $9 billion a year NFL can surely afford. Only half of the settlement is paid out in the first 3 years, the rest spread out over the next decade and a half. Lisa McHale is the widow of Tom McHale, an offensive guard who was the second former NFL player diagnosed with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, the consequence of repeated severe head injury and concussions on the field. McHale passed away in 2008. Lisa joins us now. Lisa, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thanks.
How much did your family sacrifice, do you think, not knowing what it appears the NFL knew about the threats to injuries of the head?
Well, unfortunately, I would say that we probably suffered the ultimate sacrifice. You know, I think there are a few out there that had as big a loss as we did simply because I think we had the most to lose. I don't think there are many people out there as extraordinary as my Tom had been. So it's you know, it's a tough thing to live through.
When you think about Tom's life, you feel him buried alive in his own brain. He understood something was going on. He didn't know what. He tried to solve it on his own, but it was, of course, impossible.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it's so much has changed in the last 5 years. He passed away in May of 2008, and if you take yourself back there, you kind of can realize it, that the issue of concussions really was not anything that was ever discussed, and we certainly had never heard of this disease of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And it's very hard not to, you know, to think quite a bit about how things would have been differently had we known.
And if you had known, what would you advise athletes to do today? Now we do know a lot more. What would you say about the prospect of a career in the NFL, knowing what you know?
Well, you know, that all has changed dramatically, without a doubt. We know a great deal more today about the risks. And I think, you know, it gives me a good deal of comfort to know that the players that are playing today do understand that there are risks associated with the game. It was very, very difficult to be faced with the fact that, wow, these players have been so dramatically changed and altered and affected by this and yet had no understanding of the risks. So I think it helps to know that there are, and those that will have been affected by it. And I believe there are, unfortunately, many who will have been and are struggling with it today. At least I think it's got to help to know that there is a neurological reason for what they're struggling through, and that then there's hope that they can get some relief from that, some people who can understand it, their spouses, their families can understand what's going on and perhaps be more understanding. So I think there is a great deal more hope. I think, obviously, until there's a cure, then the emphasis still has to be on prevention.
We're talking with Lisa McHale, the widow of Tom McHale, an offensive guard in the NFL, the second former NFL player diagnosed with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. We're talking about the $765 million proposed settlement with 4,000 NFL plaintiffs. How would you characterize being a football player? Is it like being an industrial worker in a coal mine, or is it more like being an entertainer? Do athletes have a responsibility to know their own risks?
Well, you know, interestingly, I think you're right that it could be certainly both can apply in different ways. The risks are significant, and I think that players always knew that there were risks to their physical health, and they make the decision on you know, on an individual basis that those risks are worth the rewards of the game, because on the other side, it is exactly as you say. They are, and certainly nowadays more so than ever in the past, they are celebrities, and they are treated as such, and they are compensated as such. But the issue of head trauma, you know, is one. It's a very different issue. People can live with physical disabilities. This head trauma thing, this disease of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, robs them essentially of the people that they are. Your brain is essentially the essence of who you are, and so it's a very different issue. I'm thankful today that the players are aware that there are risks. I really rue the days that my husband played and all of his former teammates, that they had no idea. And I'm glad that, you know, that the lawsuit has changed that now.
This relates to workers generally. I think there's always a culture of macho, of whoever takes the most risks is maybe the most reckless in the workplace, can get ahead, the most macho, the person that doesn't really think about their health often can get rewarded in the workplace, but for these kinds of agreements and this kind of awareness. What do you think Tom would say today?
Oh, wow. You know, that's a real question. This, I think, because we were so ignorant at the time of his passing to all of this, I mean, I don't know, but I know that he would be very, very, very pleased at the outcome of yesterday's announcement with the settlement. I know that he would be very pleased that his former teammates who will have been affected by this will be taken care of. And I think he'd be pleased to be at the heart of the issue and being able to help, you know, create awareness that there is a problem here and that people need to be more aware.
Lisa McHale, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Lisa McHale is the director of family relations for the Sports Legacy Institute. Her late husband, Tom McHale, was the second former NFL player diagnosed with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. McHale passed away in 2008. We're asking you, is football simply getting too dangerous? Would you let your child play?
My name is Alistair. I'm calling from Jacksonville, Florida. You know, if the kid wants to play sports, you should let him play sports. You take a risk every time you step out your front door.
Bruce from Brooklyn. My kids are going to play till they get hurt and hope that it's not a life-changing event.
But you in Denver, Colorado say, I'm coming to the conclusion that football needs to be thought of on the same level as boxing. Men are getting damaged beyond repair. Think Junior Seau. We are pushing our kids at younger and younger ages to play as though they will be playing as if they will be in the NFL. And really, look, they won't. We'd love to know your story. Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This week, the president spoke on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, and the nation paused to remember 50 years since the March on Washington.
Because they marched, city councils changed, and state legislatures changed, and Congress changed, and yes, eventually the White House changed. Because they marched, America became more free and more fair, not just for African Americans, but for women and Latinos, Asians and Native Americans, for Catholics, Jews, and Muslims, for gays, for Americans with disabilities. America changed for you and for me.
on that list of people who still perhaps await the full embrace of the American dream of Dr. Martin Luther King are the millions of undocumented immigrants in the United States. Jose Antonio Vargas, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and founder of Define America, is one of them. He was brought to the U.S. from the Philippines illegally when he was 12 years old. Having now lived and worked here for 20 years, he considers it his home, even though people around him don't necessarily consider it in the same way as his home.
For me, as somebody who's gay, as somebody who's undocumented, as somebody who's, you know, my name is very Hispanic and I look Asian, I'm Filipino, I've gotten a lot of strength from studying kind of the civil rights movement and understanding, trying to understand as much as possible why and how people endured what they had to endure. I publicly announced being undocumented in the New York Times in June 2011. By October of that year, I went to Alabama because it was really interesting that Alabama had actually out-Arizona'd Arizona. Alabama had passed the most stringent immigration law in the country, in which if you were driving me, it'd be a felony for you to drive me. There was actually a time in Alabama in 2011 where it was actually a felony for me just to even be in the state.
Before the Supreme Court.
Before the Supreme Court. Right. But what was interesting was meeting African-American leaders in Birmingham and hearing what they had to say and what they had to say and how they were connecting the dots between civil rights and immigrant rights, right? They targeted blacks. Now they're targeting brown people, right? I remember when I first met Representative John Lewis, who said to me that we may have come to this country in different ships, but we're all in the same boat.
You describe that personally your life is a kind of American civil rights pluralist wild card in the sense that you embrace so many elements of groups that have been denied in the United States. I'm wondering if you also bridge a set of narratives that compete in the United States. One is the embrace, the refinement of liberal pluralism, in essentially defining the Constitution to be what it says it is, that all men are created equal. That's one narrative going on in the United States.
Yes.
But there's another narrative, and that is of competing economic groups,
yes,
who compete on a so-called economic level playing field. But ultimately what happens there is there are winners and there are losers. The narrative of economic competition is about exclusion. The narrative of pluralism is about inclusion, but they contradict.
And that's the tension. And that has always been the tension in this country. I've been in Alabama four times now since I publicly have outed myself. I've been working in a documentary. I filmed in Birmingham. And I actually did a week-long lecture series at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. And my favorite part of that was going to a class called Dirty Jobs, in which most of the students, about 100 students, mostly white, mostly male, mostly grandsons and sons of blue-collar workers, construction workers, farmers. And it was really interesting talking to them about reminding them that we were in the South and that the South had been built on the back of cheap labor. Talk to black people about it, right? And now in the South, in places like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina, many of whom are passing these anti-immigrant laws, the agricultural economies depend on undocumented labor. And we tell to Mexico, we say to the border, keep out, right? Yet 10 yards in, what do we say? Job wanted.
So the next 50 years for people like you and the undocumented immigrants who provide that labor is more about the economic radicalism of the March on Washington than it is the pure civil rights message, in the sense that we forget about the labor issues. We remember the sort of dream poetry of Martin Luther King Jr. We're happy to have you in the United States as workers, but in terms of granting you the ability to be prosperous and to be full participants in the United States, that's a tough one for the USA.
Well, but I think it is a moral imperative. It's an economic one, but also in the end, I think it's a moral one. If we are going to convince the American public that immigration is about the American story and about the American identity, right, and about the fact that people like me, as far as I'm concerned, I am an American. I just don't have the papers to show you. To me, that's a part of this kind of evolving American identity that happened way before we created border security and ICE and DHS. That's really the question. That's why for us, the question ultimately is, how do you define American? And Martin Luther King had said, Americans, you know, dream. What I'm saying is you are an American if you consider this place to be your home. You are an American if you consider this place what you want to contribute to. somebody like me who went through school here, who worked here, who considers this my home. This is my country. I'm just waiting for it to recognize me. I have seen probably more of this country than most Americans have seen of this country. I've been to 46 of the 50 states. I think I became an American when I know that America and Iowa and the America and Ohio and the America and California are actually the same America.
And you know Manila, right?
I left when I was 12.
You haven't been back?
I can't. I'm not allowed to leave.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I'm not allowed to leave, yes.
No, and so much has changed. I mean, New York compared to Manila is a small town.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Manila is like one of the biggest cities in the world.
I haven't seen my mother since I was 12. So no. I'm hoping for immigration reform to pass so I can actually go back and just see my mom and see what I left behind.
Is that a part of the next 50 years, thinking about what the March on Washington meant? You getting to see your mother?
Well, it's just one story and it's just one son waiting to see his mom. You know, when I think about where we are right now with immigration reform, and when I think about the fact that President Obama has deported more immigrants than any other modern president, more than 1.5 million. When I think about the fact that we are living in this really fascinating moment in our history, I wonder how we're going to look back at this time and explain to ourselves, why were we so quiet? Why were we so ignorant? Why were we so indifferent? And again, like, you know, I don't want to make any parallels about what African Americans went through and what gays go through and what undocumented people go through, but you see the connective tissues there, right? I mean, the quote that rings in my ear now as I travel around the country is this great Martin Luther King quote, in which he says that history will record that in this period of social transition, the greatest tragedy is not the strident clamor of the bad people, but the appalling silence of the good people. And we need the good people in these next few months to really kind of speak up and stand and come out about their support for people like me, because you know that we're your neighbors and your classmates and we go to the same stores and go to the same schools and we live in the same communities. I think once you talk to Americans and look them in the eye and say to them, this is not what you think it is and I am not who you think I am, my experience has been they get it.
The joyful, optimistic noise of Jose Antonio Vargas, storyteller, journalist, and founder of Define America. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And on this Friday, we want to thank all of you who shared your dreams with us. It's been an amazing look back 50 years. Have a great Labor Day weekend now. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.